The chair calls the Education Policy Committee meeting to order for Wednesday, March 5th, 2025. And we have a quorum today? We have a quorum. All right, thank you. Representative Falconer, have you had a chance to review the minutes for Tuesday, March 4th, 2025? And if so, would you approve those minutes?
Madam Chair, I have reviewed them thanks to the generous heads up you gave me, and I move them to be adopted.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Falconer moves to the approval of the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it, and the minutes of Tuesday, March 4th, 2025 are approved. Members, we have several bills on the agenda today. We'll begin with House File 877, followed by House File 1171. Both those bills will be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. We also have two technical correction bills that will serve as vehicle bills, and my intention is to send those to the General Register. And finally, we have three bills that we heard yesterday with Representative Bakeberg relating to student discipline. We won't be taking additional public testimony on that today. We heard that yesterday, but I did want to follow up with some time for member discussion. We may move one of those three bills to the General Register while laying over the other two. So we are going to begin with House File 877. Representative Mueller moves that House File 877 be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. Representative Mueller has an author's amendment. Members, we will adopt the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author prefers, and then Representative Mueller will present her bill, and I believe that amendment's in your folders. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the A2 amendment is adopted. Remember, we have two other amendments which we will act on after the bill presentation and public testimony. So, Representative Mueller, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for being here and listening to a really important bill that we are going to be discussing today. And I understand this is just the beginning of the discussion as we continue to hone our legislation so that we are able to get the best legislation out for our schools so that they are able to actually do what is necessary to make sure that we are teaching the science of reading. I will begin by saying that if you have the bill in front of you, I would encourage you to do that. Once a teacher, always a teacher, can't stop, won't stop. If you look at the beginning of the bill, we have a very specific purpose statement here, which is that all of our instruction and that our practices, interventions, teacher development, textbooks, all the instructional material would be on the science of reading. And we are very specific that evidence-based is science of reading, that there cannot be any wiggle room on that at all. We have seen too many times where other entities and have decided that evidence-based means something else, and frankly, it brings us back. It sets us back and is not getting high-quality instruction to our students. So we want to make sure that all of our instruction is based on the science of reading. Continuing on in the second page, we do explain what science of reading is. On page three of the bill, we explicitly talk about severing the relationship with carry. The amount of money that has been, and I know this isn't a finance committee, but the amount of money that has been given to carry it has taken away, frankly, from our schools for implementation and making sure that they can implement this with fidelity. And so making sure that they've had their time to do that, and we've actually heard from several of the school districts that the relationship with CARI has certainly been a barrier rather than a guidance to them. And so this is something that starting July 1 of 2025, any type of activity with the READ Act would be moved to the Minnesota Department of Education. And so we want to make sure that that is, that then that money is redirected to the schools. Starting on page 5, you do see that we have removed the language that frankly has become, and I know this is going to be a part of discussion, but frankly, this has become interpreted in a way that has become a distraction to our students, a distraction for our teachers, and has been, as we have seen from other testimony, has limited curriculum that has been nationally recognized, but apparently doesn't meet Carey's or MDE's definition of what is culturally responsive. And so we simply remove that language. I will tell you, knowing that there is an amendment coming, that I have been in conversation with Representative Jordan and Representative Clardy about what we can do to come to consensus on that. And I hope during the amendment that we're able to discuss what that looks like. In the original bill, we do have here that on page 8, that the board has to adopt, and this is Pelsby, has to adopt rules requiring applicants for Tier 3, Tier 4 license to pass an examination, and I would have you notice, and if you have a highlighter, please take it and highlight this part, or performance assessment of knowledge. This means that it does not have to be a paper-pencil test, and I've also talked to Representative Clardy and Representative Jordan about how we can put some comfort language around this to show that this doesn't necessarily have to be a paper-pencil test. I will tell you, members, that any type of state that has been looking at literacy and putting a similar READ Act reading initiative into law, that they have doubled down on reading endorsement. We are the outliers for taking it away. It is not normal for us to simply just trust teacher prep programs when we know they are not preparing our teachers. And we've heard that time and time again. And so that would make us an outlier by not having an independent mechanism to test to make sure that our teachers are knowledgeable and that they are able to teach the science of reading. But understanding that everyone learns differently, I've been a teacher for 20 years, knowing that everyone learns differently, I think that it's really important for us to put some comfort language in there about how the test does not have to be paper pencil. I will tell you, in Mississippi, where we've seen super amazing jumps in proficiency when it comes to literacy, they have a requirement for their teachers to pass an exam. That exam is 4 hours long, members, 4 hours long. So I think that there's one extreme. Our extreme is to get rid of it. I'm sure there's something that we can come to in the middle of a consensus. The amendment that you adopted, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair. This gives some language around making sure that rubrics are clear and understandable and only based on the science of reading. That we are, I frankly, apparently, am suffering from insomnia. And so at 2 a.m, I'm doing research. And I have been very diligent about trying to look at how Carey and MDE has made their evaluations for curriculum and professional development. Sometime in the middle of the night, and I do mean 2 a.m, I was able to unearth the rubric of what they've used. Because I know there are independent rubrics that are out there that other DOEs have used, such as the Reading League. They have done, and they have no stake in the game, they're an independent organization that goes and looks at different curriculum, and they have had their own. And so I have tried to compare their rubric with Carey's rubric, and frankly, it's been really difficult and quite confusing, and I'll be talking about that. This would say that the department needs to have a rubric that evaluates curriculum that's only based on the science of reading, and that that it has to be published on the website, it has to be found easily, and that anyone could be able to understand it. That's the same as with our auditing of teacher prep programs. The initial report that came out, the teacher prep programs, that's on line 4.5 through 4.7 of the amendment. The initial report was frankly quite confusing, and I couldn't quite understand what was going on. And I asked people who actually helped make that report, and they said that they're in the process of creating the rubric, and that what they originally had is just the beginning of that. Well, that... that's hopefully something that we'll be able to discuss. And I hope that as we continue on with this, we are able to so this is something that I want to make sure is in our statutes so that we are able to have some transparency in what we're doing. On going backwards, and I sorry, members, on lines 2.3 to 2.7, this is for professional development. We heard from people from other organizations that they have been places that have been nationally certified with a professional development, and yet they have not been approved by CARI to be a professional development provider. And frankly, I'm not understanding that. And so we are just kind of opening that up to be able to say that professional development requirements is department approved, and is that the professional development has been accredited by these national organizations, but that anyone who had a certification from before, that they would be able to be grandfathered in. I don't want anyone to have to repeat anything simply from our oversight. That's a long introduction, and I hope that we have a robust discussion on this. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would have my testifiers come up, or anyone who wants to come and testify at this point. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. And before we move on to testifiers, did I see some of the high school pages come in the room?
They are here.
Could you stand if you are? There you are. If you're a high school page, just stand. So these young people are part of our high school page program for the House. Is it part of the Senate, too? We're just the lucky ones in the House to get you all. So it's so fun to be able to go and meet all of them. They're from all around the state. I believe they're in 11th grade. And it's a great program, and they're shepherded by a great person. I won't say his name because I'll embarrass him. But anyway, thank you for being here, and I just want to give them a hand for being students and interested in government. So if you can just give them a hand. Thank you for being here. Thank you. Okay, so we do have some testifiers for the bill, and I will ask the testifiers when they come up to state their name for the record and any organization they represent. I will also ask each testifier to keep their comments to about 2 minutes. We won't time you per se, but please try to judge it, and I'll help you wrap it up if it gets a little long. So let's start with Dr. Justin Killian and Shelby Arnold. We'll start up first. And we'll start with Dr. Justin Killian.
Of course, it's remote.
Oh, okay, and Shelby Arnold is remote, so we'll catch that afterwards. Dr. Killian, whenever you're ready, introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Thank you, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here to speak on behalf of the 86,000 members of Education Minnesota. I hope you get some sleep soon. I would just like to start by saying that I think that we agree on more than you think we do. One of the things that we have some concerns about the bill as it is being introduced by Representative Mueller, and I would just like to run through those briefly. My members are very committed to structured literacy. They're very committed to moving towards phonics-based instruction, towards the science of reading. All of these things, we haven't been doing the best for our students for decades now, and we need to do better. However, they get very, very nervous when you handcuff them and say, you can only do this thing and this thing only. And we bring this up because the science of reading is great, and it's great for a lot of people, but it's not the thing that everybody needs all the time. Some students need the science of reading plus additional skills, and particularly I'm talking about my multilingual learners and my new-to-English students. My members will go on the record saying that they need some of the skills from previous paradigms of teaching people to reading to add to the science of reading to be able to help them. The other thing that we would like to point out is that we really, really would like to have this committee reinstate the review of materials that are culturally responsive. The reason that that is important is because the initial list of curriculum that came out last year was blatantly racist. My members went through some of the additions and the inclusions on that list, and it would shock every single person in this room if we brought some of those examples in. So clearly we need somebody sitting down and doing that analysis. And the third thing is, we would really, if you're going to put more assessments on teachers, you really need to think about how that's going to affect teacher retention. But it's also very curious that you only do it for Tier 3 and Tier 4 teachers, which are our most trained teachers. Tier 1 and Tier 2 teachers are also instructing kids on literacy, and they are not subjected to the same requirement in your bill, and that's problematic and something that needs to be considered. So we ask our GOP friends to embrace local control and not just say science of reading or nothing else. Science of reading is important, but it's one part of the toolbox, not the only part. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Shelby Arnold, who is remote. So make sure, Shelby, go ahead and say something when you're on.
Hello, everyone.
There we go. We can hear you. Go ahead and begin. If you can keep your comments to about 2 minutes, that would be appreciated. And go ahead and introduce yourself.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you for everyone for being here. I appreciate it very much. I am a second grade teacher from Renville, Minnesota, and I was contacted about this bill about having Tier 3 and Tier 4 to take more tests. And I struggled with the MTLEs, the amount of study books that I bought through Pearson, the amount of hours I studied, and then just the anxiety because it was time, and you have a lot of questions to answer in about under an hour, and my anxiety would not go well. And then with the books, you have to study for them, and they were just way too much. I felt like it was overwhelming for each standard of the MTLE test in these study books. I felt like there's no way that the standard questions from the practice books were going to be on the test. And just seeing that paper print that said did not pass, which is very demoralizing on my mental health. And we want to support teachers, and you always say that we need to support teachers. And by doing possibly with these tests for Tier 3 and Tier 4 tests are not supporting the teachers. And so overall, I do not believe that this bill should be passed. I don't think tests define teachers. I think how we are defined as a teacher is supporting our students, whether that's LGBTQ students, students of color, students of ELL, or any type of students is what makes us a great teacher. And overall, I do not agree with these potential new tests. And if we implement this test, this will increase teacher burnout in Minnesota, and we're already at a major high teacher burnout. And that's pretty much it, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have Cindy Russell and Karen Sande. They could make their way up to the table. And Cindy Russell, whenever you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
Good afternoon, Chair Bennett, Representative Mueller, and the committee. My name is Cindy Russell. I'm the Executive Director of the Reading Center, Dyslexia Institute of Minnesota, a 74-year-old nationally accredited nonprofit that teaches dyslexic students to read and trains teachers in the science of reading. Specifically, our teaching approach is called Orton-Gillingham. It's the science of reading, and it works exquisitely well to teach struggling readers. Thank you for offering this author's amendment to the READ Act, lines 2.4 to 2.6. We're very supportive of the READ Act, but we realize that without an amendment, there's an unintended consequence in the implementation. There are three training programs currently approved by MDE, but these do not include the Reading Center's rigorous training, nor the training of my other two nationally accredited colleagues who also offer this robust training. Our trainings are robust because we cover all the elements of the science of reading, and we go beyond theory to include a hands-on practicum with students. Our trainees complete their training ready to apply this knowledge in their classrooms because of the practicum. Our three organizations trained teachers from 29 Minnesota school districts plus 32 states in the U.S. and internationally as well. Over the past 5 years, the three of us have trained over 600 teachers, but our enrollment has dropped by 44% since the READ Act was passed. This amendment supports teachers and districts, enabling local control to choose highly qualified professional development. And ultimately, it helps struggling readers, because teachers completing our training are well equipped to apply their knowledge in the classroom immediately. Further, teachers who've taken our training are currently being required to take less rigorous science of reading training that are on the approved list, which is a waste of state's funds. These teachers who've already had the best training in the state should automatically be granted a waiver. Please accept this amendment to add our nationally accredited trainings to the approved list for teachers, both for classroom teachers and for interventionists. And please automatically grant a waiver to teachers who have already taken our trainings in the past. Thank you.
Thank you. And Karen Sunday, am I saying your last name correctly?
It's Sunday, just like Monday with an Sunday with an O. But thank you, Chair Bennett, Representative Mueller, and members of the committee. My name is Karen Sunday, and I'm here today to speak in support of the amendment to add nationally accredited training organizations to the MDE list of approved training. Cindy has already introduced you a little bit to our three organizations. I'm the founder of Orton-Gillingham Reading Specialists, and Cindy is with the Reading Center in Rochester, and our third colleague is with Orton-Gillingham of Minnesota. Our organizations have been doing this high-quality professional development in the science of reading before it was ever known as the science of reading, also known as structured literacy, for many decades. Our organizations were founded by women in Minnesota who were pioneers in the field, who personally knew the researchers who were doing the groundbreaking work that started the scientific study of how reading develops. Since the 1950s, they've been international leaders in this field and have been pushing for change in how reading is taught in schools, working with Minnesota legislators for years to bring about this legislation. We were personally trained by them and have worked with them very closely. There's extensive expertise and experience among us, and our programs are all accredited by those national accrediting credentialing organizations. We thoroughly prepare teachers in both general and special ed to teach their students to read by including that practicum experience, which is lacking in the approved programs. To train a teacher without including a practicum is like taking driver's ed without doing behind the wheel. Nobody wants those drivers on the road figuring it out as they go. And we don't want our teachers to have to do that either, especially with Minnesota's children, depending on their getting it right. There's an immense amount to learn if you're going to effectively teach in the ways that have been proven by the science of reading. I'll just repeat that, an immense amount to learn. It takes years, and they will certainly be learning as they go for years to come, but they need to hit the ground running or everyone suffers, not least of whom are the teachers themselves, who become discouraged, they get frustrated and resentful that they're having to learn something new without the proper mentoring and coaching. People learn skills by doing them, not merely by reading about them or observing others doing them. As has become abundantly clear as we've been teaching our children to read, one size does not fit all for the children, and it's the same for the teachers. Not every teacher needs the deeper dive that our training provides, but there are many who do. Any special ed teacher needs to have more in-depth knowledge of how learning to read happens and how to tailor their teaching to the often very significant needs of their specific students. Teacher knowledge cannot be a mile wide and an inch deep. Student success is dependent on their teachers having the appropriate skills. Unfortunately, our organizations have not been on the list of approved options. And the three programs that are on that list are some of them are relative newcomers. Instruction is the same for all participants, and a mandatory practicum is not included. There's a wealth of resources here in Minnesota, and we ask that our organizations be recognized as professional development providers under the READ Act, and that funding be directed toward it, with the districts having the flexibility to determine which of their staff needs it. Thank you for this opportunity to share this information today.
Thank you. And next we have Bobby Burnham, Minnesota Department of Education. Go ahead and whenever you get seated and ready, introduce yourself for the record, please. Thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Bobby Burnham, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you, Chair Bennett and Representative Mueller and committee members, for your continued commitment to supporting the important work of the READ Act and for keeping literacy a priority of this committee's work. I would like to share our perspective on House File 877 and how it would impact current momentum in the implementation of the READ Act happening as we speak across the state. The language before us that alters the terminology from the original READ Act statute, specifically adding the science of reading to replace evidence-based structured literacy, could have an impact on the progress we have made across the state in transitioning our practices and policies to require evidence-based foundational instructional practices. We prefer the term evidence-based structured literacy as it means an approach to reading instruction in which teachers carefully structure important literacy skills, concepts, and the sequence of instruction to facilitate children's literacy learning and progress. Structured literacy is characterized by the provision of systematic, explicit, sequential, and diagnostic instruction by the provision or instruction in phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, oral language development, and reading comprehension. The science of reading is informed by many branches of science, but may be too broad for the targeted purposes of the READ Act. As you know, CARI by statute has played a role in the implementation of the READ Act. The deliverables CARI has been contracted to complete will not be finished by this bill's June 30th, 2025 deadline, and MDE does not yet have the capacity or level of expertise to complete certain required actions currently being undertaken by CARI. Key implementation milestones that MDE has accomplished since the READ Act passed include establishing the Regional Literacy Network, which required crucial infrastructure and capacity building supports. The momentum and the trust that has been built between districts and their regional literacy network has been one of the vital factors to the progress made to date with the READ Act. CARI has been an important partner in developing this support structure. There have been challenges with CARI, as to be expected with any large-scale statewide implementation effort. Those challenges have been met head-on and resolved as quickly as possible. If the partnership with CARI were terminated, MDE would need resources to staff and continue to implement those tasks currently assigned to CARI. And of course, we feel it is imperative for students to see themselves in their daily instruction as well as materials. Therefore, taking out all references for culturally and linguistically responsive and diverse populations does harm our Minnesota students and families. Another area to note is that MDE, in partnership with the Regional Literacy Network, has already developed the paraprofessional and volunteer training and plan to pilot this spring. Therefore, those funds could be allocated to the regional literacy networks. Thank you for the opportunity to share our comments, and MDE always stands ready to provide feedback and join conversations on ways we can continue to strengthen the READ Act together in order to ensure all Minnesota students are successful. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to our testifiers, and public testimony is now closed. So members, we now have a few amendments. Two other amendments, actually. We'll begin with the A3, which is being offered by Representative Jordan. Would you like to move your amendment, Representative Jordan?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Please explain your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller, for discussing this amendment with me yesterday. And as I talk to you, but I want everyone to know this, I have concerns about mandating another test for educators to take. We know that educators are people, and not all of them are great test takers, but that doesn't mean that they're not great teachers. I also have the other reason why I'm bringing this forward, which would delete your language around the test to achieve a Tier 3 or Tier 4 license for teachers, is because we also have a teacher shortage, as you talk about quite often. And so having more tests that we don't know exactly what test is being specified. I also shared that concern about bringing back the MTLE with you. It's should just so other folks know that is a concern that I have, is bringing back MTLE. I'm glad that you're saying that it's not necessarily that test or a paper pencil test or a 4-hour test, but I do have concerns about adding another test that would make it harder for teachers to be in the field teaching. We also know that tests do have racial bias. We know that that's just the case, that the way a lot of tests has been written shows bias that is happening, and that means that teachers are often failing not because they're a bad teacher, but because it's a bad test. And so I have concerns about adding a new test for teachers to have to take to get those licenses, which are definitely, some of our higher levels of licensure. We want more teachers to be getting those licenses, and I don't necessarily want to put a barrier in this way. So I would ask for member support to adopt the A3 amendment.
Representative Mueller, any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Jordan. We really did have a good conversation about this, and I also had a really good conversation with Representative Clardy about this. I do have a couple of responses to that. So first of all, as I said in my introduction, it doesn't say that it has to be an actual examination. It said it can be a performative assessment. And so I've already talked to Christina Parra about how we can put some comfort language around that. We would be the outlier of not having some sort of independent mechanism to actually make sure our teachers are being trained in the science of reading. You talked about how it's harder to be in the field. It's also harder to be in the field if you can't actually teach how to teach reading. If you can't do the job, that makes it also really hard. And it's not our fault of our teachers. It's because they weren't trained in the science of reading. That also makes it hard. And that also leads to teacher burnout and teacher shortage. The idea of racial bias, Pelsby is the one who makes the tests. Are you telling me that Pelsby's racist? And so they're the ones who decided which tests to take and which ones to do. So I think that if we want to make that be a point that we can come to a consensus, that we should put some other language around that. I think it's ill-advised to remove an independent mechanism, especially because we know teachers are struggling. Teachers are struggling not because of their fault, but because they were not properly trained. And that causes much. I'll tell you, the READ Act right now, as it's trying to be implemented, overregulated, underfunded, they have to go through training now too. That's an extra thing too. So we're already asking them to go through it. We're already asking them to go through extra training. So I think there's many ways for us to show mastery of skill. And I think when we heard about the hands-on practicum, that could be a great way to show mastery of skill. That's not a paper pencil test. I really think there is a way for us to come to consensus. And so, members, I would ask you to not adopt this amendment, as I am very adamant that we need to have some sort of actual independent mechanism to make sure that they can teach reading, and that those who are hiring these teachers know that they're ready to be in the classroom to teach reading, and also knowing that there are ongoing conversations about this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Jordan, any closing comments on your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Muir, I appreciate you working on this. There's a lot to go. I think for now, I would still ask members to vote yes on this, but I look forward to working with you on this.
Thank you, members. We'll now proceed to a vote on the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Nay. The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. So now we have the A4 amendment, and that is being offered by Representative Green. Representative Green, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I move Amendment 4 for consideration.
Thank you, Representative Green. And go ahead and explain your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amendment 4 is an amendment that would reinstate the language that was stricken, that literacy curriculum would need to also be culturally and linguistically responsive. We heard from our teachers today about this and the curriculum choices that have reviewed that they are not all inclusive to all of our kids. We also know that research shows that students perform better when learning materials reflect their culture. There's research about that that we know about, and that teachers should really have the appropriate tools to teach all kids so that we can maximize their outcomes. And the diversity in our state continues to grow. I also believe that it is possible to have curriculum that delivers a rigorous tool to teach reading and be responsive to the diverse population of our students. I don't think they are mutually exclusive. So this is important to the students in our state. It's important for our teachers to have the right tools to teach them, and we know it is effective in implementing the READ Act, and that's why I believe we should keep it in.
Representative Mueller, comments on the A4.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm so glad we're having this discussion. Thank you so much, Representative Green, for bringing this amendment. Because this, frankly, is something that I think, again, when we have a little bit more conversation, we're going to ultimately come to a consensus to. Again, I've had conversations with Representative Jordan and with Representative Clardy already. And let me just give you a little bit of where I'm coming from and the reason why it's been taken out initially. It's because when I've had the distinct pleasure of going to two different elementary school classrooms, one in Monroe and one in Sonneson, that uses the Bridge to Read curriculum, which now, just after about 2 years of trying to be approved by MDE and CARI, have now been approved as highly rigorous. I watched in these classrooms these kindergartners and second graders. This curriculum had, as you had described it, seeing themselves in the instruction. They definitely were able to see themselves in the instruction with the pictures, with the sentences, with the different things they were asked to read. They were able to see themselves. And as they were being instructed, I saw people from Africa, people from Burma, people from Latin America. I mean, all over the place. And that's what it is in Austin. And all these kids were learning how to read. And I was amazed watching it. Matter of fact, Ed Allies has a report on this, and it actually shows all the different, and I can give this and pass it around, Madam Chair, if you'd like, but it says kindergarten and first grade early reading screening from spring 2024 shows 90% of the students are reaching proficiency indicators. And these are from the Monroe students. And it didn't matter what color of the skin it was because the curriculum was highly rigorous. I also believe that it is not mutually exclusive. But I also believe, as I've been watching and looking up things, that the way that it is defined by CARI and MDE is not what we're talking about. So I did some digging, and after finding it, thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me, it says, and this is directly from CARI and MDU's website after I found it. This is from the Amplify, when they went and looked at the curriculum from Amplify, which is a highly nationally accredited curriculum, what was not approved by MDE and CARI all. Because the culturally responsive look-fors are embedded throughout the rubric, the last page of this report lists together along with considerations. It is important to note that this is a small portion of cultural responsiveness, and districts should look at publishers' diversity of representation tables as well as look at, and they present a link. So I clicked on the link because I had that kind of time at 2:00 in the morning. And what it brought me with was culturally responsive English language arts curriculum scorecard. This is a highly politically charged rhetoric. It's not what you and I are talking about when it comes to seeing ourselves in instruction. It's much more than that. And this is the direction that MDE and CARI are giving our schools. And so, and in one of the letters I received, unintentionally, this has led to exclusion of high-quality, diverse ELL programs from the Minnesota Department of MDE. This is from a teacher who actually teaches literacy. So I think that it's really important for us to remember that while we're talking about what culturally responsive is, that we make sure that it is, not what you said, mutually exclusive. It is not mutually exclusive. And so we are working with Christina Pera and with Representative Jordan and Representative Clardy to come up with a definition of culturally responsive that is what you and I are talking about, because this isn't it. This isn't it. And I'd be happy to share this with the committee as well. So members, I heard from some of the testifiers that we need to see ourselves in the instructions, otherwise it harms our students and family. I don't know. I think the families in Monroe who are getting 90% proficiency are not being harmed. They're learning how to read. This is generational change, that they're learning how to read. That's amazing, and it should be celebrated. And so, Madam Chair, we are working on this, and we're hoping to come up with a consensus around a good definition. Currently, right now, I would ask that members would vote no.
Members, any further discussion on the A4 amendment?
Madam Chair, could I follow up? Madam Chair, may I have some follow up?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yes, thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Sorry.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Representative Mueller, for that that answer. I'm not sure if we define culturally responsive exactly the same way, so I'll just put that out there. But I actually would love to bring one of our testifiers back up, Dr. Killian from Education Minnesota, to hear from our teachers. I appreciate that you had two schools that you referenced, but I think a view of all 87,000 teachers.
Yeah. Representative Green, important. We generally don't do that. Dr. Killian, I'm sorry, but we don't call public testifiers back up. We do have, if there were testifiers at the table, we consult them. So we typically.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Could you just repeat what you're looking for?
No, I just thought that we, Representative Mueller had referenced two schools, which is great. I love to hear that the proficiency is going through the ceiling there. I love that. But I just thought a teacher's perspective, because they did testify. I did speak ahead of time to make sure that this was okay.
We'll allow a real brief. Dr. Killian, if you want to come up and just speak briefly. I do kind of want to keep this moving because we have another bill as well, but we'll.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Dr. Killian, or you want to ask a question,
I believe. Thank you, Chair Bennett. Yes, I was going to ask, can you rephrase the question, Representative Green?
She asked the question yet.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for coming up. I guess I just want to get your opinion about, you mentioned about the importance of having material, reading material, and feedback from your teachers. And can you speak to that about a little bit more and the importance of that and how that impacts classrooms across our state?
Dr. Killian.
Yes. So I can give you a very specific example, and it's from the Dakota County United Educators, so District 196, Apple Valley Eagan, and I'm forgetting the third, Rosemont, Apple Valley Eagan. So our teachers last year, so as Representative Mueller pointed out, there was already a preliminary review of curricula, and there was a list that was presented of like these made it through and these are approved and these are not approved and emerging and all kinds of different classifications. And you are correct that there were culturally responsive elements embedded within that curriculum. Even with those things embedded within the rubric used to judge, the racist book still made it through, and it was our members who were sitting on these curricula committees that were coming to us and showing us actual slides from the vendors that were selling these books. And like one of the books was for a sixth grade audience, and it talked about a romantic relationship between a Civil War soldier and a slave woman. And it referred to her in very derogatory terms. And this was for fourth or fifth grade. And this made it onto the approved list. So something's wrong with the rubric, and racist stuff is really getting through. And when the vendor was, when our teachers responded to the vendor and said, what is this? Their response was, well, we could take it out for your district if it bothers you. And they were like, it's not just about our kids, it's about all kids. And they could walk through examples of how like detrimental that is. It doesn't matter how great the phonics instruction is. If you're reading a text that talks about someone that looks like you in a derogatory manner, the skill's not gonna land home. And these examples were coming in all over the state last year, which is why we fought very hard to have this additional review put in place, was to make sure that these things didn't happen. And I have a panel of teachers that would be more than willing to sit down with any of you and walk you through these examples and why this is scary to them.
Representative Green, follow up.
Thank you so much, Doctor. I appreciate that. No further questions.
Chair Bennett.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming up and explaining. Fourth and fifth and sixth grade is not when you're is not the foundational skills of when we're teaching them how to read. We're talking about kindergarten, first, second, and third grade. That's what the law says, that they have to be able to read at grade level by grade three. So fourth, fifth, and sixth, yeah, that's I would never teach that, and that sounds horrible. But we're talking about fourth, fifth, and sixth, and the rubric that they mentioned here for kindergarten through third grade has things in here that, frankly, are for things that we should be watching out for our upper middle school grades. Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's make sure we do that. But we're talking about kindergarten through third grade. And the things that we're looking at here are things like power and privilege. And I know we've talked about this, but kindergarten, first, second, third grade, learning how to read. And I may have a different opinion about things from some of my other colleagues, because I don't think that we should be having horrible things like that in our schools. But again, if you can't read it, you don't even have the point of being offended because you can't read. And so let's make sure that we actually have our foundational skills, and that's what I'm talking about. So thank you for that. And at the curriculum that you're talking about, I believe, has also been used in Colorado, and they have gone ahead and went ahead and tailored it for their state as well. Textbook publisher companies want to actually sell textbooks, so they would be willing to, you know, work with you. And I agree, that's not something that should be in there, but they actually want to sell textbooks. And so if there is something that you want to be able to talk about, then let's do that. But again, your example from fifth and sixth grade, that is not applicable to kindergarten through third grade.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Mueller, again, for our conversation on this subject as well. I'm glad we continue to work on this. But I saw an example of, like, kindergarten and first grade text where all of the black characters in the books were literally tribes people. That's kind of, like, so, you know, and it's like there's pictures, and the black people all lived in stick huts. And I think we can all agree that that is not a good thing for our kids to be hearing, is that the other part of this textbook and curriculum that I saw was that all of the portrayals of Native Americans were people who lived in teepees and rode horses and was an old, like, John Ford Wild West kind of portrayal of Native Americans. We have many Native American and black students in our schools that are learning how to read with this. If the examples they have are that, and that is some of the curriculum that was being shown around that I saw that I had teachers bring to me. And so that's why this is being brought up, and that's why this language was actually included last year, is because there was a need that was brought forward. So I'm glad you're going to keep working on this, but it is concerning to see this taken out, and that's also why I would recommend members vote aye on the A4 amendment.
Thank you. And Representative Mueller, I'm happy that you are willing to work with Representative Clardy, Jordan, and Green, and whoever to come up with a great definition. So members, let's move on to a vote here with the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Oh. The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. All right, so Representative Mueller, that concludes the amendments. We should, any further discussion on the bill? Representative Jordan, Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller. Again, I thank you for your conversation. I will reiterate that. I also want to thank you for knowing your bill. It is really great to be able to talk to a member. Thank you. It's really good to see. And it's obvious that you've spent a lot of work on this, and it's reflected in your bill. I am wondering if MDE would be willing to come to the testifiers table. I have a few questions about some of the guidance that you're giving. So I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Burnham, I only really have like one or two questions.
Assistant Commissioner Burnham, go ahead and reintroduce yourself for the record if you would.
Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Ed.
Thank you, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner. We heard a little bit about guidance that MDE was giving. Can you talk a little bit about that guidance that MDE, when MDE is talking to a school about the READ Act and how to implement it, What does that look like from MBE's perspective, and how is that happening? There's questions about carry. There's all these questions. Can you just walk us through what that process is?
Go ahead. Thank you, Representative, Madam Chair. It depends on what the questions are. I mean, the READ Act is a very comprehensive reform effort, so there are many arms and legs to it. So the core of the support given to districts and educators through the READ Act is the Regional Literacy Network. And so the bulk of the guidance is developed and implemented through the Regional Literacy Network. So it's our staff in partnership with CARI who is building capacity and coaching the staff of the Regional Literacy Networks to support the districts. And that is done in multiple ways. We collect the local literacy plan, which gives us an abundant amount of program data and soon will give us student data. We have communities of practice for the literacy leads in each region, the coaches in each region, as well as the literacy leads in each district, which there are about 85% of the districts now have a designated literacy lead. So a lot of our communication and a lot of our support is through those avenues. And a lot of the information is on our website as well. I'm not sure if that's the kind of...
Representative Jordan.
Okay. Sorry, I'm figuring out my mic. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's helpful. Is there, I mean, how, I also sometimes struggle with our state's websites. How is that accessed? And then how is there a place for schools to ask questions of either MDE or CARI? How is that labor handled? And then I'll also just ask my last question too, so we can move on. And then if the relationship with CARI went away, is there a, like, as I know we're not a fiscal component, but can you say how many FTEs, like, that would be required to do that work? How would that work if the relationship with CARI was severed at this time from an MDE workload capacity?
Ms. Burnham.
Madam Chair, Representative. So we have kind of multiple ways that we communicate and provide opportunities for districts and school leaders to ask questions or to seek input. We have open office hours every month. We have a newsletter that goes out every month, and we address topics in that newsletter from what we're hearing from the field. Again, we have the website, and a lot of the questions and around guidance and support come through, again, the Regional Literacy Network, and then those literacy leads in each region brings them to the collective leadership team, and they are all addressed together and consistently, so that one region isn't off kind of doing their own thing while others are following the guidance that has been put out. So we have been, I have been working in partnership with our fiscal note staff at MDE, trying to figure out what it is that MDE may need should the partnership with CARI go away. I believe currently, with the funds that CARI has received, they have a total different percentages of different people, but about 10 FTEs. Some of the activities that CARI was contracted to do have been completed, others have not. And for those that have not, we put 4 FTEs in our fiscal note to provide the ongoing support that CARI is providing. So we are looking at that, and, you know, some of those more intense areas definitely is the ongoing curriculum review process, the intervention review process. MDE just simply isn't staffed to do that, nor have the level of expertise right now to do to continue that review cycle and have that thorough knowledge of that review process for intervention and curriculum.
Thank you. And just remember to keep the focus on the policy items here because we can discuss the fiscal components in ed finance. But Representative Jordan.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just wrap up. Representative Mueller, I think, again, like I said, you've worked hard on this bill. I don't think it's currently in a shape where I can support it, so I will be voting no on it today. But thank you for being willing to work on this going forward. Literacy is very important. We know that kids need to be in school and they need to be learning how to read. So It's good to see that we can all agree on that, and there's plenty of work going forward. I think we'll all be talking about the READ Act for the rest of our legislative careers, so thanks.
Representative Mueller, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the great discussion and for the good questions. I really appreciate that. I would love to also kind of respond a little bit, just briefly, Madam Chair, about MDE. I mean, we need to have a serious discussion about what the role of MDE is then. If hiring four new FTEs to be able to help schools focus on literacy and they weren't there before, I'm sorry, what have they been doing then? I appreciate the work that Bobby has been doing, and I know that she is very passionate about this, and she has been trying to get this done with fidelity. I do not fault her at all for any of that. But I'm sorry, this is something that I remember talking about during my first term, which was back in 2020, when there was an auditor report that said that they weren't able to do it because they simply didn't have enough staff. Well, how much staff is enough? I know, well, I don't know because we haven't been able to find a complete list, but the list that we finally saw in EdFi was hundreds of people, hundreds. And if your job as MDE is to give guidance to schools and you haven't been doing literacy, what's your job then? What's your job that you should have been doing this already? And frankly, having to give you more money while our, and I know this is not FI, but having to give you more money while our schools are deciding to cut teachers and programs is unacceptable. Is unacceptable. They should be able to do this, move some people around. Hiring four FTEs, they should be doing this already. Literacy is the foundation of our democracy, guys. We do not have an educated society without being literate. And we're seeing it work, but it is overregulated and underfunded. And so I want us to make sure that we are focused on literacy so that we are able to give the schools the tools that they need and the guidance that they need so they can do this with fidelity. I thank you that this is one of those bipartisan issues that maybe we're squabbling over right now and how to do it. But I really believe this is going to be something that we're going to be able to come to consensus to. So with that, Madam Chair, I would renew my motion to re-refer this to Education Finance.
Representative Mueller renews the motion that House File 877, as amended, be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 877, as amended, is re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. Members, next on the agenda, we have House File 1171, so Representative Ray Rauer can make her way to the table. Representative Ray Rauer, welcome to the committee. While you get yourself situated, Representative Jordan moves that House File 1171 be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. I'll let you get seated there. Okay, Representative Ray Rauer, go ahead and present your bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And I want to start with a big thank you to Chair Bennett for signing on as a co-author to this bill. And also thank you to Representative Joachim and Representative Engen for also signing on. So HF 1171 is a bill to provide funding for Math Corps. Math Corps is a proven instructional support. It improves student learning on foundational math skills. It's an AmeriCorps-powered tutoring program that provides kindergarten through eighth grade students with up to 90 minutes of weekly tutoring in small groups. The Math Corps tutors get extensive training. It's also done in partnership with the schools. And the tutoring program helps students acquire the foundational math skills that are needed to be successful. So foundational mathematics learning is as important as literacy is, but it often hasn't been getting as much attention in the media. Math Corps is one of the most cost-effective programs because students grasp the concepts more quickly. Math Corps requires the fewest hours to produce a whole month of extra learning as compared to other math tutoring programs. And we also know it is an impactful program through multiple randomized controlled trials. In addition, it's listed as an effective program by external validators, including Stanford University and Johns Hopkins University. As a teacher myself, I have many years of experience in the classroom, as I see multiple of you on this committee do also. With class sizes bulging today too often, and I've personally experienced this, we need to move on in our lessons once the, you know, most of our students have mastered that skill and are ready to move on. But unfortunately, that means that some students haven't yet achieved mastery of certain skills. And in mathematics in particular, it's extremely important for a student's ongoing success to master the concepts and skills at each level, because the next set of skills builds on the previous ones. So that's what's so great about Math Corps. As a science teacher, I also greatly appreciate that they use assessment instruments that and practices that ensure its validity, and they do regular fidelity checks to ensure effective delivery of instruction. They take a student-centered approach to learning. Students get the support with the skills they need to develop, and then those students advance skill to skill once they demonstrate competency in those foundational math skills. So the approach actually aligns with extensive research and also teacher knowledge to how math skills develop. So to kind of summarize, Math Corps has high impact, evidence-based tutoring instruction, a high return on investment, it can be delivered at scale, and it's proven to improve student achievement. But I'd like to share kind of a student-focused result to wrap up with. Student confidence also increases, and their sense of belonging increases. So after Math Corps tutoring, students are much more likely to say yes in a survey to this statement. I know if there is a hard math problem, I can figure it out if I work at it. So just want to again say thank you, Madam Chair. I do have testifiers here today. We have David Parker with me, and we also, looks like, do we have Principal Fant online possibly? Okay, great. So
great. David Parker, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you for your time this afternoon. I'm David Parker. I'm the Vice President of Research and Development at CERB Minnesota. And like any good researcher, I have some visual aids for you. So you can track along on the screen, or it should be in your packet. But I'm just going to underscore a few things that were said in the opening comments. But I want to start with the importance of math to the state, and really any state. Many of you have probably seen something that happens in the state's MCA scores, where you see the percentage in fourth grade here, and then the percentage in eighth grade here. So you see, as the rigor of math goes up, our students' skills on average to meet that rigor is kind of going down. So they're kind of losing ground against those target skill levels. In addition to that, many of you maybe heard in the last couple of months, the NAEP results started coming out. And in those results, we saw at both grades, really many grades, we're losing ground overall in general on our math scores. So I wanted to start with this quote from the Edunomics Educational Policy and Economics think tank that just notes how critically important math scores, eighth grade math scores in particular, are for a state's economic growth. And that's because of the value that math has for kids' future learning while they're in school, and the doors that it opens in STEM careers and other valuable careers that a state's economic health really depends on. When those scores go down, that potential to contribute to the economy and to have those benefits for math really goes down as well. So Math Corps changes that. Math Corps has a demonstrated track record in getting more students on track to be able to experience those benefits and contribute those benefits at a social level. It was mentioned earlier, but here's the visual aid of some of the endorsing parties. And it's worth noting that these span the coasts, and it also spans a lot of different expertise in our country. So this is not us. These are external parties who look under the hood, who look at the research, look at the finances of the program, and say, well, this program is earning the highest kind of level of endorsement that we can give because it is so impactful and has so rigorously been evaluated. That said, that's not the most important part. It's the kids. So it's really about the impact of the program at an individual child level. So this figure is showing what that looks like on average for our kids. It's an additional 3 months or about a semester growth that the MathCore program contributes to their math learning during their service time. And that's depicted there with the blue line starting all in the same spot as these studies need to do. We equate the starting point of the kids, but then the kids who are getting MathCore are able to accelerate at that faster rate. And then again, as was mentioned, it's not just about the kind of the outcomes for the kids with MathCore. We've also been lucky enough to have external parties come in and take a look at the finances and the cost effectiveness. And what you see on this figure is golf scoring, right? Less is more, less is better. And so really what you're seeing there, I've got the arrow there shown for you so you can see it. So MathCore requires the fewest number of hours to produce a month of additional growth. And that's just amongst its peers of evidence-based, kind of strongly rigorous programs. So you weed out a lot of the other math programs that are out there that don't have that evidence. You're down to this kind of list that's on the x-axis. And MathCore, by a decent margin, is the most cost-effective. Has great implications for the state. So then lastly, I want to bring it back to those benefits at an individual level. Over on the right, we know that our tutors are coming from the communities of the kids. So they are getting a meaningful service experience. That has immense value by itself. But they're also, as we track them and we stay in touch with them, we know they're going into careers in education, and that is particularly important for math, as we need math educators. And then one last point just for our students, kind of ties in nicely to the quote that was just shared. Our students are reporting greater confidence in math. And I think we've all probably heard somebody say, or maybe even said themselves, you know, I'm just not a math person. And that's not okay. You can't say that. Don't say that. We should all be invested in being math people, both because it's good for us as individuals, but also go back to that economic research that over decades has shown that math has that relationship that's demonstrated to the economic health of the state and our communities. What MathCore is doing is it is increasing the students' confidence so that they can see themselves as mathematicians, they can see themselves taking more rigorous math, and they can see themselves in careers where math is necessary. Thank you very much.
All right, and I believe we have a remote testifier next. Jody Fant, is that correct? Jody? Right. There you are, Jody. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time this afternoon. My name is Jody Ann Fant. I am the principal at Barnum High School. We are a 712 school with 310 students, about 30 minutes south of Duluth. Like many greater Minnesota districts, we face challenges in passing operating referendums, making it difficult to hire and train intervention specialists. That is why MathCore and ReadingCore are essential for meeting our students' needs. At Barnum, we rely heavily on MathCore to support our Tier 2 students through evidence-based interventions delivered individually and in small groups. Our MathCore tutor, Roxanne, collaborates closely with our 7th and 8th grade teachers, aligning with the curriculum to provide targeted support. Her work not only builds students' confidence, but also helps them engage more actively in the classroom. One of our students who had struggled with math for years exemplifies this impact of MathCore. Gaps in foundational skills held him back, but with Roxanne's support, he quickly grasped key concepts. Initially, he joined Math League, as he stated, to get out of class. He surprised himself by becoming the team's top scorer and earning a spot at the regional Math Counts competition. Today, he no longer needs MathCore intervention. He just needed the right support in a small group setting to unlock his potential. Without math core, schools like ours would struggle to provide students with these critical math supports. We've seen the impact firsthand, and I could bring on 4 math core tutors. That would make a world of difference in our district. I urge you to continue investing in this program. Our students and students across the state need this vital resource. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Thank you to the testifiers. I don't believe we have any other public testimony, so we will move and proceed to member discussion. Members, do we have any discussion? Representative Jordan?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ray Rauer, for bringing a bill forward. You've had a lot of teachers, but we're, you know, I know this is an evidence-based program. Do you have evidence for how teachers feel about Math Corps in their schools?
Yes, thank you so much, Representative Jordan. There is, yes, it is a part of the work that Math Corps does. There's also research and development at the statewide level, and they make adjustments, and they can do that very rapidly. But as far as what teachers think, there are internal coaches, so it's typically the math lead in the school, and those were the folks asked their opinions of Math Corps. And of those results, 98% either agreed or strongly agreed that partnering with Math Corps had positive impacts on schools. 99% agreed that there was a positive impact on students, and 97% agreed that they would recommend the program to other schools.
Representative Jordan, follow
up. Yep, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ray Rauer. Math Corps is a great program. It's already in our base, so that's something that I just think it's also interesting that you're bringing back some of this evidence-based policy. I think that's great to see. So I think it's a good bill, and I'll be adding my name as co-author.
Wonderful.
And Representative Ray Rauer, I actually have a question too here. And first I want to say Reading Corps and Math Corps, I think, are excellent programs. They're soundly evidence-based, which I really appreciate. I worked with, I don't think Math Corps was around when I was teaching in Albert Lee, but Reading Corps was, and it was an excellent program. It was in our building, and I always appreciated it as a first grade teacher and saw good results from it. So I do have a question in the bill. It says Minnesota Math Corps must use evidence-based instructional support. That's line 1.11 to evaluate and accelerate student learning and so on. My question is, do we have a definition for evidence-based in regards to math?
Is this one that you want, or do you want me?
I can certainly try to answer that. So, Madam Chair, committee.
Mr. Parker, go ahead.
What's it?
Parker, right, Mr. Parker?
Yes.
Go ahead.
And for the record, I do have a doctoral degree in educational psychology. So I spent some time thinking about evidence-based things. So in this case, the definition for us, when we're thinking about evidence-based program, it's been subject to external rigorous randomized control trials where they're it's the gold standard of evaluation for being able to make a causal claim. And those causal claims really matter for making an evidence-based claim. And so Math Corps meets that criteria, and that's really what drives the program showing up on all of those endorsed lists.
Thank you. And I guess I would encourage Representative Ray Rauer to work with different entities to come up with maybe something in statute that's a definition, you know, something that you all agree upon and we agree upon it. It's just, I know in Reading, as we're working with that, and Representative Mueller would I know, echo this, is it was so important to have a good definition. So something I think could be worked on as this moves on. Yeah. And obviously this is not the last stop. So members, anybody else? Okay. Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as far as I understand it, Math Corps has been around for the last decade or so, and I think the program goals are admirable, and I don't have a problem with that, I guess. But my question is, why are we working with an outside organization to assist students and teachers with instructional support? I mean, what is it that the Minnesota Department of Education does around here?
Representative Gordon, are you asking that question?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know you don't want to have testifiers come back up, but I think we've got somebody from the Minnesota Department of Education. I'd like to know, I guess, are they providing some of this in-house support? Or, I mean, why is it that we need to pay outside organizations to do what I think they should probably be doing? It should be something that's in their purview, shouldn't it?
Would anybody from the Department of Education like to add to that? We have Mr. Uni. Mr. Uni, we're always glad when you're here. Good resource. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Committee members, for the record, my name is Adosh Uni. I am the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. We, in fact, had our expert, Assistant Commissioner Burnham, who worked deeply on this when we had a math initiative in 2023. Much of the focus in 2023 was around the READ Act. We did have some funding tucked into that bill around and associated with the MTSS Compass work around setting up math work networks around the state, where we worked with regional centers of excellence and Minnesota Department of Education to help spread access to best practices around numeracy around the state. I would have to go back to Assistant Commissioner Burnham and our members in our academic standards team and supports to get more in-depth information around the activities that we engage in. But we do spend time focusing on math education. But one thing I'll note, and this is kind of goes to the some other comments that were made, you know, what we can require of districts and what we can do does many times have to be spelled out in statute. And so much of what we were able to do under the READ Act currently is through statutory authority. So when there's questions about what a Department of Education is able to do or require of districts, we would have to have the authority to do it. But we are focused on providing guidance at the level we have from the funding that we got in 2023 through our academic standards team. We host a range of data and have experts come in to help share information. We host seminars, we host professional development opportunities for educators and curriculum directors, but many times we do partner with partners like Math Corps to be able to go out and do the good work in a more deep fashion, embed individuals in regions, in districts, who are able to have build those relationships at a deeper level than MDE is able to do. I will note, and there was discussion around the number of staff that MDE does have. We have 850,000 students in the state. We have over 536 LEAs. The reach of what it would take for the number of staff that we have at MDE to be able to touch every district and be able to work with every student educator is a tall task. There is some limitations to the ability that a state agency is able to do. So partnering with groups and entities like Math Corps is pretty essential to be able to deliver that education statewide.
Representative Gordon, follow up.
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Oh, excuse me, Representative Rebauer.
Yeah, I can also provide an answer to that. So, for my experience as a teacher, what I was kind of talking about is with class sizes being much larger today than when I started my career in 1999, there just isn't the capacity and the time for a teacher to provide that one-on-one, two-on-one, three-on-one instruction for those couple of kids in your class that you know weren't quite ready to move on from those foundational skills. So this Math Corps provides that capacity. It allows us to harness the power of volunteers. So and this could be a great discussion for the Ed Finance Committee too, but that's a great return on investment because you've got a smaller number of folks training these volunteers in a very evidence-based approach, and then we harness those volunteers that are working, you know, on their own time all across the state. So it's a way to really expand the capacity to be able to provide that small group or even one-on-one instruction and get those kids up to where they need to be on those skills.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I mean, and I don't have a problem with the new language that's here. I just have a problem with MDE not pulling their weight. And I've got some other concerns as well, but that's all I have for now.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question maybe for you, Mr. Adoshini. The AmeriCorps staff Are these mostly younger graduates from college who are just, I'm somewhat familiar with some of the AmeriCorps programs. I'm just wondering if this is one that harnesses youth coming out of college and into certain programs. There's all kinds of different ones, I believe. So this is just one, and as I understand it, it's giving those students kind of a one-of-a-kind experience to get in and see the education department and see if that ends up being something that they would like to pursue.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Committee. The short answer is we have tutors from across the age range and life kind of path range. It's kind of a, we call it trimodal, which means we kind of see peaks across the age, kind of right after high school or college. You got some mid-career changers, and then you've got some post-career folks. And so it's really, and that's the spirit of the community service idea behind the tutoring, really get people where they're at. And it often people are surprised that it's not just skewing towards kind of your college age students. It's not. It's one of the things that makes it a little bit more accessible kind of across the estate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. And we have Representative Lawrence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have two questions. And I know that there's a cost investment that you're looking for here. What districts will be impacted and how many students will be impacted by this?
Who would like to take that one? Mr. Parker?
You know, I can offer a placeholder and we can maybe follow up with you. Thank you for the question, committee. As I understand it, I might be looking. Do you have an answer to that?
Well, I have that they have served 7,000 students this year. So as far as what the capacity will grow, I think we'll have to get back to that.
Right. Relative to the current appropriation, you could imagine a million adding whatever that is. That would allow the expansion for us to be able to kind of place the members across the state. What communities? We partner across the state. We like to partner with our rural communities that are looking for that additional capacity, like we talked about in a previous question. But we're in communities of every size, every corner of the state.
Representative Lawrence.
Follow up. Yep, thank you. Could you be more specific? How many? Obviously, you said you're in many communities. We're not in every one. We're not in every district, right? So.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Downham, would you like to address that one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Josh Downham with Serve Minnesota. Representative Lawrence, we have 375 tutors across the state serving 150 districts. As Mr. Parker said, the funding in this bill is one-time in nature, but it would allow us to grow. And we'd use that million over the 2 years of the biennium. So it'd be $500,000 each year of the biennium to help expand the number of sites and number of students that are impacted.
Representative Lawrence? Okay, that looks like that's the end of our member discussion. Representative Jordan, do you want any kind of a final comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a good bill, and I would encourage us all to support it.
Representative Rehauer, would you like to close your bill? Yeah,
thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to everyone, and thank you for your great questions. I just want to add that as far as the question asked specifically about the tutors and their age, there is also the requirement that another school staff member is supervising while that's happening, so safety is important. And in addition, there are schools asking for more support and asking for more that they can't provide right now. So increasing capacity will meet the need that's out there. And so I urge you to vote for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, I apologize for the last minute change here, but we are going to actually hold this bill and lay it over for now until we see the forecast tomorrow. So, you know, I do still support the bill, but we want to wait for that forecast. So I'm going to just lay the bill over at this point. So, as amended, so House File.
Sorry.
Oh, it was not amended. Okay, here we go. House File 1171 has been laid over, and we will definitely address this again. So, members, next we have two technical correction bills that will serve as vehicle bills. So I ask for your indulgence as we simply move these bills out to the general register. The chair moves that House File 1491 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and House File 1491 is placed on the General Register. And again, the chair moves House File 1492 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and House File 1492 is placed on the General Register. And so we have a few extra minutes here, members. The following bills were heard on March 4th, so we have the remaining time for member discussion on House File 514, House File 1052, and House File 1436. Representative Bakeberg will be joining us for this discussion. Members, the plan is we'll be sending House File 1052 to the General Register. The other two bills will be held in reserve by the committee, as I expect Representative Bakeberg will continue to work with advocates to find some common ground for a bipartisan approach. And Representative Bakeberg, I really appreciate all your ways that you incorporate various opinions and perspectives. I heard a lot of great comments after committee yesterday about that. So, members, if you can kind of think back to yesterday on those three bills about the student discipline issues, do we have Representative Bakeberg, do you want to make a comment before we start our member discussion?
Sure, I can just start out real quickly just to kind of frame what we talked about yesterday. So we're going to discuss the three discipline bills. Thank you to the testifiers that are here that are not here as well. And just before we jump in, I just want to be very clear about my purpose with these bills. And very simply, if I'm going to talk in school terms, the learning target of these bills are to ensure that every single person, every single individual that walks into school, whether they're a teacher, a cook, a custodian, a para, a superintendent, district office, principal, whoever walks into the building is feeling safe. Most importantly, every single kid. Every single kid. So with that, Madam Chair, and for the sake of time, we can just move into member discussion.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. And members, do we have any discussion on the bill? Wow, quiet group, okay.
All right, I guess. I'd move it to the register.
Representative Keeler? I had to get all my notes ready. Representative Keeler, you go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bakeberg, and thank you for providing us the time to have this conversation. I think when we have so many bills, it's really good for us to have conversations as the committee does work really well. So I want to start with just, I feel like we were getting a bunch of numbers that were like, we think it's about this percent or like it's almost this percent. So one of the questions I do have that I would like an honest response to, and if you don't know the actual number, we can follow up with it, but how many of the dismissals that have happened were individuals who were identified as special education students? I know that it seems like there's this overlap in disciplinary actions with special education students. And so that was just one of my first questions to help frame the rest of my questions.
Representative Bakeberg.
Yeah, so I think the most recent report that I'm aware of, so as a building principal, at the end of every year, well, I do it at the end of every year, but there's something called the DIRS suite. It's the Discipline Incident Reporting Suite. So anytime a student is suspended either in or out of school, we have to submit that data to the department. And in 2022, this report was generated about suspensions and expulsions. And I think, honestly, this would be a really good report for us to sit down and really dive into in a smaller group outside of committee, because frankly, this structure just isn't good for it. But if you go to page 4 of that report, it breaks down. Now, this is lagging data. This is from 2022, is the most current that we have. But students with disabilities accounted for 14% of the suspensions. The racial makeup of our school, and this was for the 18-19 school year. So you have to think all the way back. And just a few things have happened in our society since 18 and 19. But we were about 49% students of color across the state and 51% students that are white. Then you look at, then the report goes into subjective discipline. And students of color were disciplined for subjective reasons, and we have to dig into the what that is, but that's like disruptive behavior. So like my definition of disruptive behavior is going to be different than Representative Keeler's, and different than Representative Roach's. And to be honest, it's different for educators in September than it is in March. So for a whole host of reasons. People get tired, all of that. Then you get into disabilities, it's 14%. And then you look at subjective discipline for students with disabilities. They were disciplined. So that's suspensions or expulsions. 59% of the time. And 41% students without disabilities.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to do my best to keep going through the chair, but I do have a lot of questions or conversation to have with you. So that's helpful. I do think that one of the things that you and I have chatted about in the attendance lane is really understanding how we're leaning into students' IEPs appropriately and making sure, like 14%, that's a lot in my mind, especially if there are students who have mental health or medical behaviors that are documented that they need the supports. I also know that we just don't have a robust special education system to provide the supports. And so I would be really interesting in diving into how do we make sure that if and if we make any changes, we're absolutely protecting the students who have IEPs. Do you want to make a comment to that?
Go ahead, Representative Keeler.
Okay. And so so that's kind of the first thing. The second thing is leaning into attendance, because there's nothing in here that talks about how we would code this. You and I are deeply working on how we code things. And having a kid miss 3 days of school, we know that there's the educational impact, like how we do that. And so in your mind, in our conversations when it comes to attendance, how do you see this looking like? Because if a student is asked to leave school twice, that's already half of their allotted like chronic absenteeism, and it's based on the school deciding to not have them there. And so can you tell me what your thought process is around how this would be coded?
Coded, yeah.
Representative Bakeberg.
Madam Chair, thank you. Rein me in if I get off course, but
I think both of us, because we both can get off course.
So I think just practically right now, it would be coded as an excused absence. I'm open to having conversations so that we can have better data. But I think it's important to understand that when a student is suspended, regardless of where they're at in the age, we have to follow the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. So the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act very clearly outlines what we have to do. And there's something in there called a readmission plan. And this is really the most powerful part. And frankly, in my professional role, I've gotten hopefully a lot better at the readmission plan than I was when I first started. So there's really three parts to the readmission plan. We sit down with parents or guardians and with the student, because we want the student to own what was happening. So the first part of the readmission plan is just to answer any questions, to provide complete clarity as to what happened. So I have gotten a call where my kid has gotten suspended, so you're not maybe thinking real clearly. So you want to ensure that parents understand all of the facts that happened. So you answer any questions. That's the first thing you talk through. The second thing is you talk about attendance and you talk about homework and making sure that the student is able to access learning one way or the other. So oftentimes what we do now is there are many of our staff have recorded video lessons, so the student is able to access that through Google Classroom. The third thing is the part that I think that I personally have grown the most in, and it's really just a plan moving forward. How do we support this student? What do we do to make sure? And we heard a lot of testimony yesterday about really, frankly, horrific things that happen to kids. Now, I've done this job long enough to know that what is said at the testifier table, or frankly, what's posted online on social media, isn't all the facts. And the school can't say their side of things, so that's just a bigger frustration. But during that readmittance meeting, we have a really robust conversation, and we're looking at child find. So are there some things that we're missing from a special ed standpoint to make sure that we're not missing something for a kid? Does a kid need additional supports? And you think about that tiered intervention support that Mr. Glenn talked about. Tier one are just those common things, the just best practice. Tier two are, you know, like a check-in, check-out, meeting with a counselor, meeting in a small group. Those are all things that are discussed within that that conversation in the readmission plan. We work together collaboratively with families to develop a plan to support that student. And then the other part that we talk a lot about with families is, okay, there were people that were harmed with this. So then it's called a restorative conversation. If both sides are open to it, we get people together and we talk. And we get to families that were hurt by something get to share what happened. Can I say that that happens in every single school in the state? I can't. I can tell you every school that I've worked in, and many, many of my colleagues that I've talked to do that same process. What I can say, and the principal association's attorney is back here, and he does the trainings on the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act for principals, and he has walked through that in just about every discipline training I've been in my almost 20 years as administrator. So I think that's probably answered more than you were asking, but yeah, guilty as charged.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Why do you do that? Because then my brain goes to like all the other things, right? And I really,
Representative Keeler, like I said, I call you to the dynamic duel. So
yeah, for right reasons. So the excuse part of it just, and maybe that needs to move more into the attendance conversation, but if we're already preparing like access to learning and they're getting the learning components of the day, they're just not in the physical building, is that really excused or is it just learning from another location? Because what I don't want it to look like is if the teachers are doing a really good job at preparing student A because they're gone for 3 days so that when they come back, they didn't miss the reading lessons, they're not actually like missing school from an education component. So I just want to think a little bit bigger about that.
Representative
Baker? I think a reason why marking them excused is in part, like I hear what you're saying from that standpoint, I've never thought of it from that perspective, to be honest, is a safety piece as well. So that if we have something that happens in the school,
right,
we know that, you know, Ben Bakeberg is not in his fourth hour class. So that's why from the teacher's side, they would need to mark excused. But I could see a way, I could see a coding way. Open that.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I do think that that's important, especially because, like, it's good for us to know the data of this and when excuse is just lumped into everything. Like, this was an ask of the school.
Yeah.
Based on behavior. So I'm going to lean into something else. And I wish I could have said this yesterday because it's just not the same when we have none of the people who testified yesterday. But it really, really matters the words that adults use when they're talking about our kids. And yesterday it was extremely disturbing to me how many adults said things like, when a child is no longer welcome in school, we should never in Minnesota be okay with landing on a position that a child is just no longer welcome in school. That's a problem for me. Another thing is, well, just trust us. And I can tell you as a community that's like lived in a world that we're just supposed to trust our teachers and our education systems, that's just not true. And so I think to build trust, you know, it is this relational component. And I like what you're talking about, that there's this like restorative practice to it. But we have to practice that before we just tell kids you have to trust us, or parents that you have to trust us. The other thing that was really didn't sit well with me is one of your testifiers said, well, it's just a small inconvenience to parents for their children to be home for 3 days. That's completely false. Because for parents who are working, for parents who have other things going on in their life, it's not just a small inconvenience. It's a pretty major inconvenience to have your kid be home with you. And I understand. So like this concept that when kids are sent home from school because of behavior issues, it's just not a big deal for the parents. Like it is a big deal for the parents. And so making sure that like, what if that parent can't take time off of work and then we're telling a kid they can't be home, but then they also can't be at home or at home with an adult. That's another child protection issue that we need to be really careful of. But then the other thing was like, well, maybe this would be a first eye-opening experience about mental health with kids. Well, like if kids are having behavior issues, chances are they're like deeply rooted in some behavior mental health components. And so I want to be mindful of how adults really talk about our kids. And when these individuals were principals and individuals who were making decisions, like, I've been to your school. I see how you navigate your school. I trust that you're a good principal in your school. Not everybody is a principal Bakeberg. And I just want to be mindful that, like, this is why when we say subjectiveness on whose behavior is determined to be gone for 3 days or whose behavior we'll just let ride out, it's things like that that make me really, really nervous because we see that the community that's being pushed out of schools are communities that look like me, based on communities that look like you. And that's the reality. Like you just gave us the data that shows that it's kids, Native kids are expelled on way higher of a rate than the percent that were in school. And I can tell you working in Indian education, that's not made up. I've seen it full blown happen in my middle schools. We would have one of my kids would be walking down the class with some shoes that left little black marks. And because that was property damage, he was sent home. Mom just said, I can't afford new shoes. We have other kids who are literally throwing things at the lights and at the windows and breaking them in a school. And we're just going to like call mom and say that this is a problem and we can't do it. So when it's left up to this subjective space and we're hearing the adults in the schools talk about kids in this way, like no wonder that we don't have great outcomes. And so how do you plan to make sure that the subjectiveness of just like, because people can look at me and think I'm just a worse off kid than you based on how we look without knowing anything about us. And so how are you sure that we would set up a system that is not race-based based on if a kid is more likely to be a menace in school or not? Because we see that happen. We hear it happen. A lot of our testifiers talked about that. So how would you ensure that there's a mechanism that wouldn't be based on biasness?
Before I go to Representative Bakeberg, I just remind members, we have probably about 3 more minutes. We do have a hard stop because of our caucus meetings. But Representative Bakeberg, go ahead.
So, yeah, I mean, I think to be very transparent, if I had all of the answers to address the disparities, not only in suspensions, but in achievement, frankly, I would package that, I would sell that, and I would make a lot of money. Because that's the reality of there are disparities in our society. So I think I can talk about a couple of things. First thing is what we have done in our district and across Scott County, a number of years ago, we started something called Caring and Committed Conversations. And there's a partnership between three of the districts, all of the districts that I represent, and we have ongoing conversations about really hard topics, about this. And so if you ever want to come, you can come. And actually, representatives from the department have come to those conversations. One of the most powerful conversations, I was sitting with a young man and a student of color, and he said, Mr. Bakeberg, before you came, he said the teacher's name, I'm not going to, but he said he kicked me out of class, and I sat in that class for the rest of the year, and I always wondered if he's still mad at me. And I'm like, well, have you ever talked to him? And he said, no, I've never talked to him. And I said, well, has the teacher ever talked to you and said, we're good? And he's like, no. So we put in place that if a student is removed from class, it is the responsibility of the teacher to reconnect with that student prior to that kid coming back to class. Like, that's a good best practice. Now, do we need to pass a law to do that? No, that's good practice. I think I'll go back to this report. If you go to page 16, and I could go through a lot of these, but there's a lot of recommendations in here that are put on schools, that are put on the state, that were and were not followed. So if you flip to, when you have this, if you flip to page 16, it's talking about exactly what you're talking about, Representative Keeler. And it's talking about the disparities, and the heading is called Give Schools the Support That They Need. That's professional development, obviously, but it says the state can continue to support its work to end disparities by working collaboratively with schools, educators, students, families, other agencies, community organizations, national experts to develop effective guidance parameters, frameworks for creating school climates that are inclusive and equitable. To ensure schools have the support they need, continue investments in essential work. Here are two recommendations that came from the Human Rights Report, which I'll be honest, I completely disagree with many of the recommendations in here. But this is something, it says, so the recommendation is provide district schools with the resources they need to enact these learning within their own context, because every district is different. Prioritize support for districts who exhibit the largest discipline disparities. What happened in the bill that we're talking about is we did a one-size-fits-all mandate. We treated every single district the same, every single one in the state. Okay? We should have used a tiered approach based off of this recommendation to say, tier one, most schools are doing well. Tier two, schools need some support. And based off of my research, there's about 10 to 15 schools that were really struggling with the disparities. We should have put our support there and not done a statewide mandate to be able to really attack the discipline disparities. And I'll wrap
Thank
it up.
Thank you, there. Representative Bakeberg. That's probably going to be your wrap right there. Sorry. Members, I just want to remind you the reason we're laying over, and I'll get you, Representative Jordan, 1 second, Representative Keeler, too. We're laying over two of the bills because we will readdress this as a committee. We're just going to move the one bill forward, the other two, because Representative Bakeberg is going to work with others. But Representative Jordan, I'll let you wrap this up real quick, and then we'll vote.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is Wednesday. Wednesdays are hard. Because of the timing and other reasons. But so I guess that is my concern then, Madam Chair and Representative Bakeberg, is that we're moving this to the general register when it's obvious that you're still working on this. And for that, I commend you. And I will also extend the same gratitude for knowing your bill and knowing your subject area. That's really great. But it also, you keep saying that you're open to having conversations. Lots of your testifiers and some of the people that you've been testified against your bill mentioned that they were also grateful that you were still working on this. I guess I want to make sure that we're not having bills on good. I think we all agree that good work happens in committee, and that's because the public gets to see the conversation. They get to hear, oh, we're hearing this about all these disparities, and we're hearing this about there being maybe these tiers that you were talking about. That's not reflected in 1052, which is the bill that's going to the general register. So I have a big problem with that. I also don't feel like, I'm glad that we all also acknowledge that there are massive racial disparities there aren't anymore, but there have been massive racial disparities for which children were suspended between the ages of kindergarten and third grade. And we know that children with disabilities are also much more likely to be suspended. In fact, one of your testifiers, one of your principals, said that 75% of the between kindergarten and third grade students that he suspended were on IEPs and required special education services. That's 75%. That's way higher than any of them. I've seen a lot of different numbers about the disparities, which is also a challenge. But that's a problem. These are the kids that need to be in school. The other thing, too, we spent a lot of time today talking about literacy, which is great. We all talked about how we all like talking about that. You can't learn to read if you're not in school. These are kids that need to be in school more than ever. Like, kids need to be in school. It is a safe place for kids to be in school, and they need to be learning. And kicking them out for 1 to 3 days is a big deal for a kindergartner with special needs. That's a big deal. And this is a one-size-fits-all policy that we're advancing. So with that, I cannot support sending House File 1052 to the General Register today. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. The chair moves that House File 1052 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed say nay.
No.
No.
No. Motion prevails, and House File 1052 is placed on the General Register. All right. Then we have the chair moves House File 514 before the committee and lays over the bill for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. And the chair also moves House File 1436 before the committee and lays it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for further consideration at a later date. Members, thank you for the great discussions on all these bills. That concludes today's agenda. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 11th. And with that, the committee stands adjourned.